Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Back to school.
Backpacks.
Lockers.
Lockers to hide in.
Get out of that locker, Eugene. Speaking of school, what's the biggest lesson you ever learned?
To subscribe to Patreon to help keep this show on the air.
Ooh, I was out sick that day. How do I subscribe?
Well, to be one of the cool kids. Become one of our Patreon supporters and help keep us on the air. Head on over to patreon.com. That's patreon.com or patreon.com. And search for Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Set up a monthly donation. Even $1 a month helps us. You know the routine, guys. Your contribution helps us continue doing what you're doing and bringing all these amazing stories to your ears.
Good to know. Well, I am going to subscribe and get a note to get out of PE.
Rob.
I have bone spurs.
Oh.
Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Broadway Curtain. And make sure to join our Facebook page at Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
And follow us on Instagram at Broadway Curtain Podcast. Plus, you can always listen to our podcasts on Broadway World and Stitcher.
Trailblazer. That is the word that we can best use to describe the historic work of today's guests. While we will discuss his many fabulous and wonderful Broadway credits, his work on revitalizing the musical theater scene in Los Angeles, and more importantly, his position as a founding member of Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS are major causes of celebration.
That's right. As a Tony Award-winning producer, today's guest has given the world such shows as the 1974 Gypsy with Angela Lansbury, 1989's Gypsy with Tyne Daly, The Royal Family, Platinum, can't wait for that one, The Mad Woman of Central Park West.
Can't wait for that one.
Wally's Cafe, and the original Cash Reunion of Company and Tuck Everlasting, to name just a few.
To tell us what it was like to work with such legends as Arthur Lawrence, Elaine Stritch, Jerry Herman, Alexis Smith, Phyllis Newman, James Coco, Ellis Rabb, and so many more, here is the one and only Tony Award-winning producer, Barry Brown.
Good morning.
Hi,
good
Barry. Welcome.
Thank you.
I'm so glad you're here.
Okay, what would you like to know?
Oh, my. Oh,
I know you want to know everything.
We do. We want to know absolutely everything. But you know where we're going to start first was a name that we were talking about before we went on the air. And that was your producing partner, Fritz Holt.
Yes.
And this is, I think, one of the first times his name is coming up on the podcast.
Yes.
And he was a legend in our industry. Would you be so kind as to tell us who he was and how you guys hooked up with each other?
Fritz was a stage manager. I think he started out as a prop boy, actually, at Mineola. Remember the Mineola Playhouse?
Okay.
No, you guys are too young.
We've heard of it.
He
was the assistant stage manager on the National Company of Cabaret.
Oh, okay.
And clearly Hal saw something in him and brought him to New York, and he wound up being the PSM of Company and then the PSM of Follies.
Okay.
And it was going to be the PSM of A Little Night Music, but then he and I got together and decided to become producers, and so that was almost the end of his stage managing career.
Almost.
And I think he is pretty much acknowledged to be, or to have been, the best stage manager in the city.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody would argue with that.
Wow. We were just saying before we started that there should almost be a Tony Award for best stage management.
I think stage managers are the unsung heroes of theater.
Could not agree more.
No question about
agreed.
It.
Agreed. Totally agree.
We were saying also that, you know, the fact that the show runs so smoothly is a sign of a good stage manager. You know, that there's never a problem, that it's a happy company, all the technical elements, all of that stuff.
Well, there's never a problem as far as the audience is concerned.
Right. Oh, there are tons of problems.
What goes on backstage is another story.
Ain't that the truth?
Yeah.
So now, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Brooklyn.
What part of Brooklyn?
Flatbush.
Okay. Good answer.
Born and raised, went away to school, came back to New York, and my dad was a music publisher. He worked for Chapel Music, which published virtually all
everything of
the theater music in those days. So musical theater was always at home. And he, when I graduated from college, I taught school for 3 years in an inner city school in Brooklyn.
Oh, okay.
And then my dad got me a job with BMI, and I gravitated toward the theater end of it.
Uh-huh.
And there we are.
So did you go to see shows when you were growing up as well?
What was your first Broadway show? My first Broadway show, I think, was something called Texas Lil Darlin', I think.
Texas Lil Darlin'.
We, Over 200 guests. This is the first person who said the first Broadway show was Texas
of hours
Little Darling. This is great.
Of interviews, and we've never gotten that one before.
Well, I don't. I
Lots
don't
of
even,
My Fair Ladies.
I remember like the, very little about. Oh, in fact, I believe it was at the Hellinger.
Oh my goodness.
Oh,
speaking
okay.
of Fair Lady. But I know an early one was Peter Pan, not the musical, but the one with Gene Arthur.
Oh,
and
yes, with the Bruce
and Boris Karloff
music. I think, yeah.
You got to see the great Gene Arthur on stage?
Wow. Yes.
I'm jealous.
You think I remember?
Okay, so you saw those.
And everything, you know, that was Chapel, everything Rodgers and Hammerstein and Lerner and Lowe and the Gershwins and Cole Porter and anything that was in the Chapel catalog, my dad took us to, my sister and myself.
And did you ever want to be a performer?
Was never.
That ever, no, that was never an option.
No talent. Seriously.
Really? Doesn't stop a lot of people.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So good.
I am a triple threat. Can't sing, can't dance, can't act.
I love that.
Wait, so did you go away to school when you were in high school? Or
No, graduated from,
Yeah.
No, I graduated from Midwood.
Okay, so you graduated from college, you taught for a little bit. When did we go from I'm going to stop teaching to now I'm getting into the performing arts?
Well, when I went to work for BMI.
Mm-hmm. That was
right after I finished teaching.
Okay.
And as I say, I gravitated toward the theater end of it.
Why did you stop teaching, though? Why did you say I'm going
to go? Because I got to the age where they were not drafting anymore.
Ah!
Yeah.
It was the Vietnam War. I'm old, see? And I thought that I was far better off in Brownsville, Brooklyn than in Vietnam.
Yes.
Yeah.
And sure enough, I was.
And were your parents supportive of you going into saying, I'm leaving teaching behind, I'm going into to BMI and maybe a performing
Absolutely.
Arts career?
Absolutely.
Well, your dad had been doing it.
But my dad was in the, you know, at Chapel forever.
Yeah.
So he felt good about it.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
So what were some of your duties at BMI?
I started off in the public relations department, just writing or retyping things that you send out, just
like the press releases,
and then sort of gravitated toward was put into the writer relations. So I would go around. It's a great job. I would go around to the little places off Broadway, and try to find new talent for BMI.
Oh well,
that sounds like an ideal job.
Oh, it was a great job.
Yeah,
it was great.
You saw everything, and then you.
I did.
You'd
I'm not sure.
Back,
I can't remember anybody I particularly discovered. But I had a wonderful time looking.
When did you start to develop an eye for producing or the urge to start producing things?
I had no idea what a producer was. While I was at BMI, somebody had asked me if I wanted to go to London and co-produce The Last Sweet Days of Isaac, which was an off-Broadway show by Gretchen Cryer and Nancy Ford. A really good show, by the way.
Totally. We just had Gretchen on the show.
I listened to it.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I did, absolutely. And I had met Fritz. I had known Steve Sondheim, obviously, because of my father's connection. I mean, because he was a Chapel writer.
Right.
And so I went up to Boston for a weekend to visit Steve while Follies was trying out there. But it turns out it was the weekend, just when they were replacing Can That Boy Foxtrot.
Mm.
And Steve had to go away and write a new song. So he turned to the stage manager and said, Fritz, this is Barry. Barry, this is Fritz. And said to Fritz, just could you please make sure that Barry gets in to see the show whenever he needs to, whenever he wants to. So that's how I met Fritz. And then when they came back to New York, Fritz and I remained friends. And I used to go and hang out at the Winter Garden, mostly, I have to say, in Yvonne's dressing room, because we just had such a great time.
Tell us about Yvonne DiCarlo.
She was wonderful. She was fun and stories forever. She was, at one point, I'll use the word indebted because I don't know what else to say, to some men in black from Brooklyn. And Fritz and I, at that point, were raising money to do Gypsy. And she said, you know, why don't you, and in order to repay her indebtedness, she, for I think about 8 weeks running, had a car would meet her at the stage door after a performance on Saturday night. And she would be whisked away to Brooklyn to perform. And so one night she said to us, why don't you come with me? And, you know, I'll introduce you to these guys. They have lots of money and, you know, you can. And we thought about it and thought, probably there are other ways to raise money for this. And so we didn't
thanks,
do
no
it.
Thanks.
But thanks,
yes.
But no thanks.
Yes.
Anyway, so Fritz and I were having supper one night after the show at Joe Allen's, and I mentioned to him about this Last Sweet Days of Isaac thing. And he said, really? You're going to leave your job and your friends and your apartment and et cetera, and go to London? He said, do an off-Broadway show? He said, don't do that. He said, if you're going to leave it here and go to London, do something big, make a big splash, go do Gypsy over there. And okay. I said, on my high horse, I don't want to do something that's already been done. And he said, it's never been done in London. Mm. And I said, Fritz, don't tell me. I said, my father publishes the music. I know what's been done. And he said, I'm telling you it hasn't. So I said, all right, sit here a minute. So I went to the phone and I called Steve. And I said, has Gypsy ever been done in London? He said, no. So I said, oh, can you take a break? Steve usually worked at night. Mm. What for? I said, well, this is what it is. And he said, sure, come on over. So I said, okay, take out the white wine, Fritz and I coming over. So we did, and we told him what it was all about. And actually, very sweetly, he said, looked at me and said, well, I would love it if your first one was one of mine. Oh. So I turned to Fritz, and I said, great, let's do this. And he said, not me. He said, I've got a good job with this man. I'm doing Follies, and I'm going to do a little night music. And I said, nothing doing. I said, this was your idea. I'm not going to do this by myself. And that's how we became producers.
My God.
You must have been pretty damn close with Sondheim.
We were good friends, yeah.
I mean, like, that he would trust you with that. And, I mean, really.
Well, he did say, before anything else, you have to go meet with Arthur Lawrence.
Uh-huh.
So what was that like?
Was that the first time you were going to meet Mr. Lawrence?
Yes, I didn't know anybody then. It was a fine meeting. He eventually told us that he thought to himself when Steve told him that he was sending, because he didn't know me or Fritz, he thought to himself, what two tricks is he sending me this time? But it turned out fine, and they all said, well, who are you thinking of doing it with? And we said, Angela Lansbury. Mm-hmm. And they said, great idea. And it then took us a couple of years to do it because she turned us down when we first offered it to her.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. We met her in London. She was on a press junket for Bed Knobs and Broomsticks. Right. She had just broken her arm. And she was really kind of retired after that movie and living with the family in Ireland. Mm-hmm. So she turned us down. Mm. And so we started to develop it with Elaine. And it only got so far. And then we got a call from Angie saying, is the office still open?
Huh.
And we said yes, and we were off and running.
Oh my goodness, incredible.
That's wild.
And that's how it happened.
Wow. Just like that. How did you know what to do? I know that sounds like a silly question, but
you know, I don't know.
Producing is about the hardest job in our business.
You just,
I mean,
somehow do it. I mean, we knew we had to raise the money, and we knew we had the property, so it's not like we had to get the material right.
Yeah. Right. How did you pick a director? How did you pick, did Angela have a say in that?
I think she was hesitant at first because, because if anyone can whistle, there had always been a rumor that Arthur, which is untrue, by the way, that Arthur wanted to have her fired. And so she was kind of skittish about having Arthur as the director. Mm-hmm. But they got together and they met, and it was very reassuring, and was thrilled to death that she said yes. And I don't know how, we just sort of did it.
What's the difference between raising money for a show then, which was the early 1970s, versus now, which is the late 2010s?
Well, now it's all about raising money. Mm. My feeling is that it's not so much now about creating shows as it is raising money when you've got to raise $15 million. Mm. Plus which you have 40 names above the title of there's no more Hal Prince in association with Ruth Mitchell Presents, right, or David Merrick Presents. Mm. But you do what you got
to
do.
Was Fritz a mentor to you in terms of this is how we're gonna do this, and this is how you do A, and this is how you do B, or were you both learning together?
We just jumped in as producers, and we got a general manager in London, and they gave us an office, and we sat down, and they were very busy They were presenting No No Nanette that same season, which was touted that was going to be the big gigantic hit, and we were sort of the ugly stepsister. Mm.
Do you know why Gypsy had never been done in London?
Nobody ever wanted to do it without Ethel.
Ah.
That's the reason.
And when you came up with the idea for Gypsy originally, was it always it's going to be Angela Lansbury in Gypsy, or was it we're doing Gypsy, we're going to look for a name to go
well,
into
Well, as soon
it?
As Fritz mentioned it, right then and there, and it's sitting at Joe Allen's, I said, who are you thinking about? And he said, I don't know, what about Angela Lansbury? And that's how it happened.
Mm.
So she was it from the beginning.
She was it from the beginning. How did you find a theater in London?
With great difficulty. Yeah. We went into the Piccadilly, which was not our first choice theater, but it was in the days, as it is today in New York, that it's a theater owner's world, and we took what we could get.
So working with Arthur Lawrence, what was that experience like?
You mean the first time?
We'll take the first time, because we know you guys get together again on Lacage.
It was terrific. It was terrific the first time, and we became extremely, extremely good friends. Fritz and I lived in the village not too far from Arthur. We'd have dinner twice a week, and, and I mean, we really became very close friends until we weren't, which, from what I gather, is often happens with Arthur.
Yes.
But the working relationship was terrific, and, you know, it's, with Fritz's knowledge and Fritz's expertise about everything backstage, Arthur was in heaven. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when it came to Lacage, Arthur said one of the conditions of him directing it was that Fritz would be the PSM and come back to stage managing, take rehearsal, take it out of town, and bring it into New York.
Mm.
He said, after opening night, you can turn it over to your assistant, but I want you there from the beginning as the PSM.
Wow. And then from a producing perspective, what do you look for out of a director? What makes it an ideal producer-director collaboration?
I think letting the director do what you hired him to do. You got to trust the people you've hired. I am not or could never be a director. Mm-hmm. So I have to rely upon the person. You know, you look for the person who you imagine has the sensibility to connect with the material that you're presenting,
mm-hmm.
not just any old director. I mean, John Huston to direct the movie of, was it Annie?
Annie, uh-huh.
Yes.
Or I forget who directed A Chorus Line. Who never
Richard Attenborough
Richard
did
Attenborough,
A Chorus Line.
I mean, hello.
From Gandhi to A Chorus
That's
Line.
Right.
Musical theater director.
Yeah, so, I mean, you pick the director who you think, you know, meshes with what the show is.
So it gets marvelous reviews on the West End, right?
Yes.
And whose idea is it then to transfer this production?
Well, we always wanted to trip from the get-go. We always knew that if it had worked in London, we would want to bring it back to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And we did it backwards. We did a 6-month tour first.
And then of
the States.
Mm-hmm.
And then brought it back and then came to the Winter Garden.
With Angela the whole time?
With Angela, yeah.
Wow.
And this was Arthur Lawrence's first time directing the piece, correct?
Yes.
So was there any hesitation about having the book writer also serve as director?
No, because it was already there. The material already there. I should never say never, but wouldn't hire a director on a new play or a new musical. I wouldn't hire the writer to direct it.
Sure.
You know, because... Right. Who's going to turn to him and tell him what's wrong with that scene?
Exactly.
And then as a producer, how much creative input do you have? I mean, if, for example, if you see something you don't like you don't like what that dress looks like, or you don't like how the actor is playing that scene, is that something you tell the director?
Yes.
You have no hesitation? Yeah.
I have no hesitation about it. You know, it's anything that I think is going to make the show better, I think I'd be remiss not to say something because I've got a responsibility to my investors.
Mm-hmm. Arthur Lawrence sometimes didn't get along with everybody, sometimes. Were there ever times as a producer that you had to, you know, smooth things out because of any interactions that he had with actors or with people, you know, designers, whatever?
Mostly on Lacage between Arthur and Alan Carr.
Okay.
Admittedly, we spent a great deal of time either undoing stuff that Alan had done or heading off things, and Arthur it was water and oil. Mm-hmm. It just, they did not get along from the beginning. And but yet, Arthur and Harvey and Jerry, it was a love fest. Huh. Mm. I mean, it was just amazing.
That's good.
Yeah.
So it was when Alan wasn't around, it was the best experience of my life.
The art of asking for money is a delicate issue and one that a lot of people feel uncomfortable with. So how, as a producer, do you ask people to invest? How do you sell someone on a show?
Well, I think first you have to believe in the show 110%. Mm-hmm. And then these days what it comes down to what's on the paper. You show them what the production budget is, and you know how much it's going to cost to put the show on, and how much the show can gross each week at 70%, 80%, 90% of capacity. And mm-hmm. so along with that comes a recoupment chart. Mm-hmm. And you can show an investor how long it'll take to recoup if we play to 70% of capacity or 80% or whatever it is. And then they see whether or not it makes financial sense.
What's the hardest show you think you've had to deal with in terms of finding investors? People going, Barry, this is not for me.
Probably Tuck. Tuck mm-hmm. Everlasting, because it was a book written for young adults, mm-hmm. it was perceived as a children's musical,
yeah,
which don't often work on Broadway right. in mm-hmm. terms of longevity.
Yeah,
and so it took convincing people that it was not.
How did you do that? How did you go about convincing?
A lot of double talk. I mean, I don't mean lying.
No.
But I mean, you know, tap dancing as fast as I could to explain what it really was about. And, you know, the tagline really said what it was about. If you could live forever, yeah. would you?
Yeah.
Would you choose to? That's what it was about.
Yeah. And as a producer, you're involved in every single aspect of putting everything together, correct?
Correct.
What do you find to be the most challenging aspect of that in terms of putting all the elements together?
Probably hiring the right director.
Hiring the right director.
Absolutely.
For it. So for something,
but there are other. I'm sorry.
Oh no, go please. No,
there
please.
Are a lot of sort of little things. I remember when we were doing Platinum.
Oh,
that's
yes.
I'll get into that in a minute. But when at the early stages of it, Fritz and I were sitting in Marvin Krause's office, who was our general manager, and Bob Mackie did the costumes.
Oh.
For Platinum, and the four of us were sitting and were talking about it, and Bob at one point looked at Marvin and said, "So what's my budget?" And Marvin was just about to tell him what it was, and Fritz said, "Don't tell him. Why in the world," this is Fritz talking, "why in the world would you want to stifle somebody's creativity? Let him go away and design what he thinks the design should be, and he'll bring it to us. And if it turns out that we're over budget, then we'll make cuts and then we'll deal with it. But why, you know, why hamstring him before he even gets started?" And which I thought was just very smart.
Yeah.
And sure enough, when push came to shove at the very end, it came in $3,000 under budget.
Wow. That's a great piece of advice. Yeah.
So, and that was Fritz.
Okay, so Gypsy comes to New York. It's a smash that I'm sure was beyond your wildest dreams. Is that?
Yes.
Okay.
In fact, we were living up on West End Avenue, and we took the number one train down to work every day. And the day that the box office opened, we got out of the train, the subway station at the 50th Street station. You know, you have to walk up all those steps. And we looked at each other and were saying, "Please let somebody be online. Please, please, please." And we sort of peeked our head up above where the sidewalk is to see if anybody was there. And there was a line down the block and around the corner.
Oh, what a relief.
What a blessing. What a joy.
And what a relief is right.
And what a relief. And whatever, and she won the Tony Award.
Yes, even though we only ran about 5 or 6 months, because by that time she, you know, had done a year in London and 6 months on the road, and now 4 or 5 months in New York, and she was tired.
So after Gypsy is done and you're closing up shop there, what's next for you?
We had, well, of course, when you start with Angela Lansbury and Gypsy, there's no way to go.
I was
going to
say, I don't know.
Which we quickly did.
But you have everybody saying, well, this guy, if he calls me, I mean, I'm going to give him my money. I mean, you get like...
That's right.
I imagine you get like a little bit amount of time, though, where you kind of get to pick whatever you want.
There was a short amount of time where we were sort of the golden boys in the city.
And just so
we were
really clear, you didn't invest in anything prior to Gypsy. Is that correct?
I did.
What did you invest in?
My father and I each invested $500 in company.
Oh,
and each invested $500 in Follies. And we made money from company.
Oh, you did?
We did. I can't remember, 10% or maybe 15%. Follies, we lost, I think, 80% of our money.
Okay.
And I invested in, I think, $500 also in 70 Girls 70.
I love that show.
Because I had become friendly with John and Fred because they were BMI writers.
Yes.
They were some of the very few theater writers who were not ASCAP, who were BMI.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
So you dabbled a little bit in investment, but Gypsy was the first. This is a Barry Brown production.
Barry Brown,
Fritz Holt production. Yeah. So then what do you two...
We would bid along with a lot of other people for the American rights to Equus. And we didn't get it.
What does that mean? I'm sorry to interrupt you. The bidding, because a lot of our listeners will probably hear that and think, "Oh yeah, sure." What is that?
We made an offer to the London producers.
Would they set out something that said, "Hey, look, we're producers of America. We're looking for someone to take this. So give us your best offers." Is that
yes. Well, once it opened and was a big hit in London, they knew they wanted to do it in New York. The London people wanted to do it in New York and would be looking for New York producers to do it.
Why does someone get it over someone else?
More money, better terms.
Okay. Mm. Wow.
So the next thing that came out of the National Theater and then went on to a huge hit in the West End, starring Frank Finlay and Joan Plowright, was a play called Saturday, Sunday, Monday. Mm-hmm. I didn't see it. Fritz went to London and saw it, and he said, we should do this. He brought me a copy of the script. I thought it was all right. I didn't think it was great, but... we learned our lesson on Equus, and so we thought maybe... So, sure enough, we were the ones who got the rights to Saturday, Sunday, Monday.
Okay.
Unfortunately. the best thing that came out of it was... It was directed by Franco Zeffirelli.
Yeah.
And the best thing that came out of it is that we stayed friends with Franco and I stayed friends with Franco till his death.
Mm.
It was a huge, I think there were 17 people in it, and everything on stage was practical. When you turned the faucet on, the water came out. And Franco, being Franco, was not about to settle for Melmac dishes on the table. He only wanted Richard Ginori dishes. Mm-hmm. But we had been introduced to a man who wanted to get into theater, and he was extremely, extremely wealthy. And put up most of the money and was happy to do it, I think partly because he wanted to be on Broadway and partly because of Franco Zeffirelli's name.
Okay, so you went from the wild success of Gypsy to how many performances did...
Not enough. I think we ran about 4 or 5 weeks. But you know, it was Seda Thompson and Eli Wallach.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't chopped liver.
Right.
But it just didn't work.
This doesn't discourage you, though, from continuing to produce.
No, I didn't know how to do anything else.
You didn't know how to do anything?
I mean, Fritz could always have become a stage manager. Yeah. Actually, he went back and stage managed a couple of things for people. Actually, that's when Bette was putting together Clams on the Half Shell.
Mm.
And somebody, they were talking, I suppose, about finding somebody to be the PSM. And I don't know whether she said or Joe Layton said, if we're going to do this, we better get Fritz Holt.
Mm-hmm.
And so he did. And he did Clams and the tour.
Were there any projects that were coming by that you thought to yourself, oh, this is maybe not the best idea, and it ended up being a massive hit? Anything that you turned down that you were approached?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Well, I turned down something on our behalf, and Fritz turned down something on our behalf.
Oh, please.
I went to I can't remember which came first, but I went to a presentation at Manhattan Theater Club when it was still up on 74th Street,
mm-hmm.
or 73rd Street, mm-hmm. and of Ain't Misbehavin'. And I thought, who's going to want to see a review of five people by who? Fats Waller? Right. Who is that? And so I said, thank you, but no thank you. On our behalf. We were offered, which Fritz turned down, unbeknownst to me, a little play called Death Trap.
Oh.
And about 5 years later, when it was still running and the movie was coming out, Fritz, our office was at the top of the Alvin Theater. Our office was Sandy the dog's dressing room when Annie was there. And we sat across a butcher block table from each other. And when the first ad came out for the movie of Death Trap, I handed it across the table to him and said, see? And he looked at me and he said, the ending still doesn't work.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Hey, podcast listeners! Are you looking for a place to rehearse in New York City that is clean, spacious, and most importantly, affordable?
Come check out Shetler Studios and Theaters, our wonderful host for these podcasts. Shetler is centrally located on West 54th Street between Broadway and 8th Avenue, right in the heart of the theater district.
Right in the heart, you'll find music, dance, and acting studios, complemented by two black box theaters and six presentation venues. The professional facilities, inspired environment, and expert industry staff combine to provide the New York artist with an unparalleled studio experience.
Visit their website at ShetlerStudios.com. That's S-H-E-T-L-E-R Studios.com.
Shetler Studios and Theaters is our home for recording the legends of Broadway, and we hope that you make it your artistic home too.
That's Shetler, S-H-E-T-L-E-R Studios.com. See you here.
Shall we talk about Platinum?
Yeah, I think it's time.
One of our favorites. We had Bruce Valanche on a few months ago.
An old pal.
Yeah, he's the best, the absolute best. So tell us a little bit about...
Well, it started life at the Studio Arena Theater in Buffalo as Sunset, it was called, with Alexis and Lisa Mordenti.
Oh, yeah.
And I think seven other people. And Tommy Toon was the director and choreographer. And it was brilliant. It was a little bit avant-garde-ish and a little bit perhaps what became Nine in sure. Tommy's mind, you know, with that kind of minimalism, and it was just wonderful. Tommy did not get along, or vice versa, with Will Holt, whose idea this whole thing was and who was the rights holder and was the book writer.
Right.
So when we closed up shop in Buffalo, Will came to us and said, it's either us or Tommy, and we own it. So Tommy was gone. And we had had such a good time with Joe Layton on Clams on the Half Shell that we brought Joe into it. We asked him if he would, and he wanted to do it. And then it became this gigantic musical, as Joe always did. And Paramount had been very interested in it. And we actually rehearsed the show on a soundstage on the Paramount lot, and Paramount put money into it, and then we came first out of town, and our producing partner, there were three of us on this one, was Gladie Rackmill, who eventually became Gladie Niederlander.
Oh yeah.
So we opened in Philadelphia, and the reviews were obituaries. Well deserved, I might add. The show just wasn't working. It just wasn't working. So we said to Gladdy, you know what? Let's just close it up here, cut our losses. No, darling. I promised Roger Stevens, because our next engagement was at the Kennedy Center, that I would bring it to the Kennedy Center. How much more money do we need to bring it to the Kennedy Center? So we told her, and she said, I'll get it. Go to the Kennedy Center. It's a dog of a show. We opened, terrible reviews, same thing. Said to Gladdy, let's close it here. No, darling. How much more will it cost for us to bring it into New York? Same scenario. We brought it into New York, into the Hellinger, and the Times critic at the time was Richard Eder. Talk about an obituary review. And it just, you could not recover from it.
What was, we talk a little bit about Joe Layton, and you just mentioned that he did kind of was notorious for sort of bigger shows, you might say. Can you tell us anything else about him that our listeners might like to know?
That he was one of the most fun, wonderful people to be with and to work with. We had a ball with him.
Yeah.
He was just terrific. And we became good friends, and we just loved being with him.
That's awesome.
So you as a producer, you and Fritz as producers, navigated quite easily between plays and musicals. And was ever a decision we should probably do one over the other, or we should be known as musical guys or play guys? Or
no.
Just whatever appealed to you.
After Clams on Saturday, Sunday, Monday, we brought in from the Kennedy Center a play called Summer Brave. Which was William Inge's rewrite of Picnic.
Yeah, I was so curious also about
this.
Also
with Alexis.
Oh, wow.
And, Smith. Alexis Smith and the guy, the stud, I forget the name of the character that William Holden played, I think, in the movie, was Ernest Thompson.
Oh, my gosh. So this was a good pedigree of people going in
Two
there.
2 weeks and out. It was our biggest flop. Among many. and then we did The Royal Family. Which I think may be among my favorite shows I ever produced.
Why is that?
Because it was so much fun to do. The most wonderful cast.
Tell us about who was in it.
It was Rosemary Harris, Eva LeGallien, Sam Levine, George Grizzard, Joe Mahar, Mary Louise Wilson, directed by Ellis Rabb. And when George Grizzard left, Ellis took over the role himself. And we just, and it was so elegant and beautifully done. Every moment, everything about it was just elegance.
This is a show that this revival is legendary. People still talk about it to this day.
That one.
Yeah, was it your idea to revive it? Was you and Fritz's idea to revive it?
We had spoken to Roger at the Kennedy Center because they were doing a whole series. And do you remember Richmond Crinkley?
No, I've never heard of
him. He was somebody who was running the Kennedy Center then. So we all got together and did The Royal Family.
Yeah.
Ellis Rabb is a name that we hear so often. What was it like being in the room with him?
He was larger than life and very much... As often as not, it was his way or the highway. But his way was, again, more often than not, the right way.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, he knew what he was doing. This was very smart.
Yeah.
Very, very smart and very creative. And he was a great actor because he took over that role from George Grizzard, and he was hilarious.
Yeah. So then that's a big bounce back for you.
Yes, that was a big hit for us.
Yeah.
Then we did the bicentennial summer at the Berkshire Theater Festival, and we did George Washington Slept Here with Jimmy Coco and Dodie Goodman.
Dodie Goodman.
Jimmy Coco, I got excited. I love him.
Jimmy had been a friend of ours.
Love him.
Just wonderful. Then we thought, well, we've made this wonderful name for ourselves in New York. We're gonna go conquer Hollywood. So we decided we're going to go out there and try to get into the movies. So we moved to LA and nobody was buying. We eventually got a job actually at Paramount, which is how Paramount became involved with Platinum. you want to talk about a dream job, we would screen movies for them to see if we thought any of the movies would make good movie musicals.
I want that job. How do I get that job?
And we came back to New York with Platinum. We were in LA for 2 years.
Oh, wow. Oh my God. Wow.
And we came back to New York with Platinum. And then we had three big flops in a row. Platinum, mm-hmm. Mad Woman of Central Park West, mm-hmm. and then Wally's Cafe, which I still think is funny.
So let's talk about Mad Woman of Central Park West.
We've talked about this on our podcast before. Yeah, celebrating.
And we just lost Phyllis.
And we just lost Phyllis.
Yeah, earlier this week. Yeah. Or last week, I should say.
You know what? It's a perfect example of the wrong reason to do a show. We did it because Arthur asked us to. Mm-hmm. He and Phyllis were extremely close friends. And he asked us if we would do it.
Oh, okay.
But you didn't, I don't want to say believe in it, but you read it or saw it and said, well, this isn't our cup of tea.
You know, Phyllis did it for us pretty much at home.
Oh, yeah.
And it was funny and touching and had something to say. And so we thought, okay, and so we'll do it. But it wasn't... If it had just been out there, I don't think it's something that we would have chosen. And then we found Wally's Cafe. I can't remember how.
And that cast.
And Fritz directed it.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
That was his... he had directed... I forget which came... When was Perfectly Frank? Do you remember that?
1980.
Yeah, 1980.
So he directed Perfectly mm-hmm. Frank. Mm-hmm. And then he directed Wally's Cafe as well.
Yeah. So he was getting more and more into directing, it seems.
A little bit. A little yeah. bit, yes. He enjoyed it. Mm. And then that was a great big flop. And then we were going to leave the business because we had no money.
So you're going to leave the business.
Yes.
And what changes?
When I tell you we had no money, we had no money. I mean, we would go. We still had our office for free up in Sandy's dressing room. Mm. And we would go down the block to Gallagher's. Mm-hmm. And we would sit at the bar because Gallagher's made their own potato chips out of... They would... cut up thick potato mm-hmm. chips, and we would have a glass of wine and eat the basket of potato chips, and that was dinner.
Oh my nice. God.
I mean, we had no money.
Yeah, not yet.
And then Alan Carr came to us with La Cage.
He just cold called? I mean, like...
Well,
just...
you know, the road to us
yeah,
and the road to what it finally became, yeah. the road was littered with bodies. Of people who Alan had hired and fired up to that point.
Yeah, like Tommy Toon was involved.
Tommy Toon was involved. Lori Essen, Jay Press, and Alan had written the book. Michael Smuin, when we came into it, was directing and choreographing. But Jay Press and Alan had reset it in New Orleans and yeah. called it the Queen of Basin Street.
Uh huh. That's when Lori Essen was involved.
Anyway, they all went away and. And Alan was about to lose his rights. And he asked us to come in and take it over. And we said, you know, you need to let us do this the way we would do it if it was ours from the beginning.
Because he was also a producer, or he was a producer who held the rights for a finite amount of time. And then...
And his rights were... His rights with the French author were running out.
Gotcha.
And I have to say, much to Alan's credit... He said, okay. And we said, just give us a few months to try to put this together. We won't do anything without your mm-hmm. approval. And so then Fritz and I sat down and looked at each other and said, what do we do now? And we both thought that Jerry Herman was the right one to do the score.
So you were literally at square one. You raised the money, but also...
No, we did not have to raise the money.
Gotcha.
That was part of our deal. We had the right, but not the obligation to raise money.
Okay.
We put it together. And so we went to William Morris and asked us if they would introduce us to Jerry Herman, and they did, and he said, I'd love to. I always wanted to do this. And we had seen Torch Song Trilogy off Broadway, and we both thought that Harvey Fierstein would... Same thing happened. It was William Morris or whoever it was introduced mm-hmm. us to, and Harvey. And then one day Jerry and Fritz and I were in Jerry's house and we were talking about directors, and a lot of names came about and fell out of our mouths. And I said, you know who really should direct this? And this, let me backtrack. At this point, Arthur, we had not spoken to Arthur for 2 years. Mm-hmm. He stopped talking to us. Why, you ask? I have no idea. but that's Arthur.
Right.
So Fritz said, if you say who I think you're going to say, I don't want to have anything to do with this.
I'm going
to California. So Jerry said, who? And I said, Arthur Lawrence. And he said, oh, do you know, he's got such a terrible reputation. Do you really want to work with him? And I said, you know, part of the problem here is that Harvey is a first-time out book writer. And what better protection?
Yeah.
Fritz said, go do what you want to do. I'm going to California. So I was visiting friends in East Hampton a few weeks later, and Arthur, you know, had a house in Quogg. So I call him up and I said, Arthur, it's Barry Brown, remember me? And he said, just.
Oh.
So I said, well, I'm in East Hampton and there's something I'd like to talk to you about. If you want me to write La Cage aux Folles, the answer is no. And I said, no, that's not it at all. But I'd like to come. And he said, okay, come tomorrow at 1:30, but don't expect lunch. So I go over there, and he was very Arthur. He folded his arms and sat back in his chair and said, well, and I said, would you be interested in directing La Cage? And he said, who's writing it? He was so smart. It was the first words out of his mouth. Mm-hmm. And I said, Jerry Herman and Harvey Fierstein. And he said, really? You have them? They're signed? And I said, yes, which we didn't. And he thought about it for about 15 seconds and sat up and said, I'll do it. And with those three words, it's like the 2 years that we hadn't spoken had just disappeared, had gone away, and he started, blah, 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 blah. He said, now have you thought about designers? What about Theoni? And just on and on, and he said, I'm coming back into town. Why don't you get Jerry and Harvey and Fritz and come down to St. Luke's, he lived on St. Luke's Place, come down to St. Luke's on Monday night, and we'll sit and we'll talk. And that's how it happened.
So you put these elements together.
Right.
This is, I think people have to remember, this is what, 1982, 83?
Correct, because we opened in June in Boston, right. June of 83.
Okay.
This is the first time, I mean, we had not seen a gay musical on Broadway before.
Right.
So what's the hesitation? What's the trepidation? How do you...
No hesitation, no trepidation. It was all about creating an entertainment.
Mm.
That's what we set out to do. Everybody, Arthur and Jerry and Harvey, that's what it was about. We knew that there might be, you know, some problems with the initial audiences, mm-hmm. of, you know, seeing at the end two men walk off arm in arm into the metaphorical sunset.
Yes.
You know, it was the first time there was a love story between two men,
right.
As a musical.
And I'm assuming there were a lot of agents telling actors, don't do this. Is that correct?
I'm sure there were. You'd have to talk to Stuart Howard,
okay.
who was our casting director, who you should talk to, by the way. He has fabulous stories.
Oh, we would.
And he was a fabulous casting director.
How did you end up with...
He was the one who brought George Hearn in. George didn't want to do it, but George is a very close friend, whatever their relationship had been. Colleen Dewhurst convinced him to do it. And he came in full drag.
Oh.
And sat up on the piano and sang. And I think he sang My Heart Belongs to Daddy. I can't remember.
Oh, smart.
And we're all sitting out in the house. And Arthur turned around to Jerry and Harvey and said, do you need to see anybody else? And that was it. He was the first one.
And how did Gene Barry come into the picture?
He, again, through, you know, Stewart gave us lists and lists of people who he thought would be right for the role. And we brought Gene in and he auditioned like everybody else. Mm-hmm. And he was terrific.
That first preview in Boston.
Well, the first preview would turn out to be our second preview. We had a technical difficulty. Mm-hmm. And Arthur went storming backstage.
Oh, no.
I don't know if you remember, there was this turntable with all the supposed houses from Saint-Tropez and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And Fritz, being Fritz, could disarm people as only he could. Remember, Fritz was 6'4".
Oh, tall man.
And Arthur was somewhat taller than this table. But
I was going to say, not that
tall. Yes. And he went storming up to Fritz. And Fritz just looked down at him and said, I don't know. He said, all of a sudden, all of Saint-Tropez met in the middle of the stage. And so Arthur said, well, fix it. And he did. And the next night, which was to have been our second preview, was our first preview. And we were off and running. I mean, the audience went nuts.
They did.
And then you came in, what, the 83, 84 Broadway season?
August of 83 we opened.
Nominated for Best Musical.
Yes.
How do you campaign? How is a Tony Awards campaign structured, if there was a campaign, besides
this is a
good show?
There was going to be. Alan, being a Hollywood person, wanted to take all sorts of ads for your consideration kind of thing. And Arthur and Fritz and I said, no, you don't do that in legitimate theater. You just don't. The cards will fall where they may. I don't say that we wouldn't have won the Tony anyway, but we were up against Sunday in the Park with George, right, which
famously
is such a brilliant show.
Yes.
And 180 degrees from what Lacage is.
Yeah, apples and oranges.
Yeah. But I think that there was a concerted drive on the part of the Schuberts and Frank Rich to push Sunday in the Park. And I think that there might have been a little bit of a backlash with the voters
because
of that.
Yeah.
And then it runs for a great number, four years, is that correct?
Yeah, almost four and a half years.
And you take it to London?
London.
Australia?
Australia. Then we mounted a California sit-down company and played 14 sold-out weeks in San Francisco, brought it to the Pantages, it ran for a year, lost all its money.
Oh.
Wait, what? Really?
Yeah.
Even after a year,
because it cost so much to do. And you know what? It was a flop in London. We lost all our money in London, too. It was in the wrong theater. I mean, I'm not saying that's the...
Yeah.
Part of it is, you know, it's ultimately an intimate story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we went into the Palladium in London Alan wanted to go into the Palladium. It was the wrong theater for it. Plus which, by that time, we made a mistake. We did Australia first and then London. And by the time we got to London, it was a full-blown AIDS epidemic worldwide. And so perhaps a story about two gay men was not something that the public wanted to see. You know, I don't know.
Especially with the misconceptions back then.
Yes.
Like at that time.
Yes. I mean, you know, it was still a gay disease then.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
And then you got involved with Broadway Cares, Equity Fights AIDS. Can you tell us how that came to be?
We did a benefit in November of 85 at the Metropolitan Opera House. Equity came to us and asked us if we would do it. I produced it, Fritz directed it, to raise money for AIDS awareness. And so we went to our friends first. We went to Bette and Peter Allen and Cheetah and said, would you? And they all said, yes, of course. So then we looked at each other and thought, this is going to be an awfully gay evening with those three, you know, starting out. We better do something about that. So we went out to California. We had been introduced sometime before that, I can't remember when, to Carol Burnett.
Mm.
So we called Carol and took her out to dinner and told her what we wanted to do and put the question to her. Because, you know, at that time, it was, I don't know if the word is dangerous, but it was for a performer to put him or herself out there in the forefront of AIDS stuff.
Yes.
Was, you know, perhaps asking for trouble.
Yeah.
In 1985,
So Carol, we put the question to Carol, and she sat there sort of looking into space for a minute, and we thought, oh, God, she really doesn't. And we said, no, it's okay if you don't want to do it, it's okay. And she said, no. She said, I'm trying to think what to wear. From the minute we announced Carol's name, everybody jumped on the bandwagon. It was as if, you know, the Good Housekeeping stamp of approval.
Yes. Yes.
By announcing Carol, and then everybody. I don't know if you've ever seen the list. I mean, from Christopher Reeve to Baryshnikov to Lily Tomlin to Ashford and Simpson and Sally Struthers and Melissa Mann. Everybody you can probably... It wound up to be almost a four-hour show.
Oh, my goodness.
Because everybody said yes.
And
we raised $1.3 million.
Oh,
yeah, wow.
But with part of that money, we gave, I think, one-third to Equity, which I believe is eventually how they joined forces with Broadway Cares and formed. and one third to GMHC, and one third. Do you know who Mathilde Krim?
Yes.
Was?
Yes. She passed away last year.
Yes, she did. Yeah. We gave one third. She had, I think it was the AIDS Medical Foundation or whatever. I can't really remember the right. And she took the money that we gave her, and she went west to Elizabeth Taylor, and they formed AMFAR.
So that money really was the start of. People had begun these, but united everybody.
It started lots of stuff that night.
Really, the legacy that we has continued to this day.
And then Fritz died in 1987.
Okay.
And somehow, I guess because of this benefit, it was called the best of the best. I kind of became the benefit maven, and I started doing benefits all over the country.
Yeah.
Most
of them were for AMFAR,
uh-huh.
But whatever city we went to, I made sure that if half went to AMFAR, half went to AIDS organizations in that city.
When Fritz Holt passed away, and this was your partner for such a long time.
Business and life.
Correct.
Yeah.
Did you think to yourself, well, I don't want to produce anything unless...
Yes. So I didn't do anything for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And then one night I was sitting watching TV and Dolly Parton had a summer replacement variety series.
Mm-hmm.
And Tyne Daly was on and sang a song.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, ha. So when it was over, I called Arthur. We were speaking at that point. And I said, what do you think about a new production of Gypsy with Tyne Daly? And he said, she doesn't sing. And he said, if she sang, would you direct it? And he said, she doesn't sing. I said, Arthur, if she sang, would you direct it? He said, you're going to have to bring her into New York. She's going to have to sing for Julie and Steve. I said, if I do that, would you direct it? He said, yes. And that's how it happened.
So this is Tyne Daly. So now what makes Tyne Daly's performance different than Angela Lansbury's performance?
They're just two different kinds of actors. Each one brought something. I mean, you've seen Angela Lansbury and whatever, and yes. So you've seen Tyne and whatever, and you know that each one will bring something completely different to the role. Everybody always says, who did you like better? And it's you know, I love them both. Yeah. They're just different.
And you did the same thing, if I remember, which is you toured the United States first, right, before
yes.
you got into New
yes.
York. What was the reason for that?
Well, I thought that we would clean up on the road because Tyne had just come off of Cagney and Lacey.
Right.
And so she was a known entity. And I thought we'd clean up on the road. We come into New York, maybe run a few months. And exactly the opposite happened. We broke even on the road and came in and were a big smashing hit in New York and ran a year and a half.
Why do you think that is?
Yeah.
Well,
I don't know. You know, if I had the answers to some of these questions, I'd be so rich. I don't know.
How did you end up at the Long Beach Civic Light Opera?
It was at a point where I was sort of had it with New York. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what to do after the Tyne Daly Gypsy. And somehow or other, somebody at Universal out in California found my name or I was suggested. I have no idea who. And they were looking for a new, it's a very fancy title, Director of Entertainment at Universal Studios. Smell me.
Yeah.
Anyway, I went out there and I met them all and they offered me the job and I took it. And I signed a year's contract and after 4 months I said, you gotta let me out of this. There's nothing creative about it for me and more important, I can't work, I can't have a boss. I never had a boss.
You've always been.
You know,
yeah.
You've been the boss. Yeah.
While I was there in those 4 months, the Long Beach Civic Light Opera came to me and said, "We are looking for a new, again, fancy title, producing artistic director."
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Oh, okay. And would you meet with us?" And I thought, Long Beach Civic Light Opera. It just didn't resonate with me at all. And to show you how not interested in it I was, I went to the lunch in shorts and a t-shirt.
Which in LA is formal.
It's casual, yeah.
It was fine for me.
Yeah.
Anyway, they told me what the whole job was about, and 4 musicals a year. I didn't have to raise any money. I would be autonomous in terms of picking mm-hmm. the musicals and the creative staff. And they told me, and I said, and you're going to pay me what? And they were going to pay me a fortune.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said yes. And so I left Universal and went right to work there.
And your first season included?
Included. My very first one was Pia Zadora in Funny Girl. And I will tell you,
what?
She was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
She was wonderful. Carol Burnett came and did Company with Carol Burnett and Patrick Cassidy.
Oh.
Dixie Carter and Elaine Stritch did Pal Joey. Nell Carter and Nipsey Russell did Hello Dolly.
That's online, by the way. Nell Carter is one of the best Dollies I've ever seen.
No question about that. She was, and we became really good friends. She was just, again, just one of the most wonderful human beings. What else? Sandy Duncan in South Pacific.
You just had fun coming up with like seasons.
I did Tyne and Charlie Durning in Ballroom.
Mm-hmm.
Leslie Uggams in she was the witch in Into the Woods. I did Chicago with Juliette Prowse, and so it was going to be Juliette Prowse was Roxy, and Annie Reinking was choreographing and was going to be Velma. And Robbie Marshall was directing it for me. So about 3 weeks before we go into rehearsal, I get a call from Annie's agent saying she can't be in the show. She needs to get back to New York to her family. She'll choreograph it, but then she needs to get back. And I said, what are you talking about? I said, we go into rehearsal in 3 weeks. This is, talk about a coincidence story if you don't believe in them. Hung up the phone with the agent. Literally within the hour, the receptionist buzzes into me and says, Barry, B.B. Neuwirth is on the phone, who I didn't know at all. She says, do you know who I am? Do I know who she is? So I said, of course. And she said, I see that you're doing it Chicago. You're doing Chicago. Do you have, do you need an understudy? And I said, well, we don't have understudies. We do 19 days of rehearsal and 19 performances. And she said, oh, God, she said, I've got to get back on stage and dance again. She said, the TV is wonderful, but I've got to dance again. And so I said, funny, you should ask. Would you consider playing Velma? And she said, isn't Annie playing this? So I explained to her, and she said, I'll do it. And I said, well, before you say that, let me tell you, we only pay, and she didn't let me finish. She said, I don't care what you pay. I'll do it. And that's how she came to do Chicago.
So what made you, I mean, this sounds like heaven. What made you decide enough is enough?
Because the writing was on the wall in terms of grants and what have you. And it was a non-fundraising board. And I sat them down at one point and I said, look to the future. I said, I'm not asking you to take out your checkbooks, but I need for you to take out your phone books. Mm-hmm. You need to go and raise money, and you need to raise X number of dollars by the end of the year, or I'm handing in my notice. Because I don't want to put up on that stage something that is going to embarrass me if there's no money. And they didn't do it. And so I handed in my notice.
And then back to New York?
Back to New York. And Arthur called and said, the first class rights to West Side Story have become available again. Really? I said, I didn't know they were unavailable. So he said, we've gotten proposals from lots of different producers. Why aren't you one of them? And I said, I didn't know anything about it. And he said, well, Steve and I were talking, we'd like for you to do it. And I said, he said, and Jerry and I are friends again, and with Robbins. And I said, you know, it's not going to be any fun. I've seen you and Jerry together, and it's not going to be any fun. I don't want to do it. At this point, I had some money from Tyne Daily Gypsy, and they pay me so much money in Long Beach. And I just don't want to do it. No, I think you should do it. So I said, no, I don't want to. So the next day, Steve calls and says, what did you say to Arthur? And I told him, and he said, we really would like you to do it. I said, and you know, getting into a bidding war with other producers is just not my style. I'm uncomfortable doing that. No, we'll see that. Anyway, sure enough, I did it. So that took 2 years. It was a two-year tour. And then a third year non-equity tour. So that brought me back to New York.
Happy that it did. Happy that it did. And so what are you working on now? What excites you now? You did Tuck Everlasting.
Yes, and I moved upstate.
Yeah, you're upstate now.
Thank you very much. And I met Doug, who is now my husband.
Dr. Doug, right?
And Dr. Doug. He's a veterinarian. Wouldn't my mother be proud of him? And I'm really not, you know, I hate the word retired. I like to say I quit as opposed to retired. But, you know, working on a couple of little things. I may be getting involved in a new little off-Broadway show. Right. And I have a couple of ideas to something that I may want to option to do a new show.
Great. It's great.
Actually, it's a revival, but
yeah.
Whatever.
All right.
It's exciting. Like this is so exciting.
So we'll see.
All right.
We are so grateful that you came by joined us today. Yeah, this is such an honor for us. Lacage was the first Broadway show I ever saw.
Was it?
Yeah.
Really?
It was.
You saw it in New York?
In New York. Wow. Yep. It was the first show my parents ever took me to.
Wow.
Plus your parents. You're a kid too.
Yeah. No, I was 3 or 4, I think. Oh yeah.
And it's funny because Doug told me that when he was graduating, he's somewhat younger than I am. Who isn't? That when they said, "What do you want for a graduation present from high school?" He said, "I want to see Lacage fall."
That's beautiful.
Changing lives.
There you are.
Changing lives. Barry, thank you so much for everything.
You're welcome.
Please come back and join us again sometime. Till next time.
Bye, everyone.
Today's episode was recorded at Shetler Studios on 244 West 54th Street. Visit Shetler Studios to book your room today, and you could be as cool as us. That's Shetler Studios.com.
And a big thanks to our sound editor, Daniel Schwartzberg, and social media manager, Bethany Ann Solecki.
And friends, don't forget, we want more folks to hear these incredible stories, and that's where you guys can come in and help us out.
Yes, in order for people to find out about us, we need lots of ratings on iTunes. The more ratings, the more they'll come up in searches. So head on over to iTunes, search for Behind the Curtain Broadway's Living Legends, click on our logo, click on ratings and reviews, then write a review and leave us 5 stars and make us feel as special as Eliza Doolittle on Eliza Doolittle Day.
Or you can leave us 1 star and make us feel as bad as Annie did in that weird production in Boston where Annie dreamed about being adopted and then ended the show back in the orphanage. True story, Rob was there.
I saw it. So head on over to iTunes and make us feel even more special than we already do.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.